Hello and welcome to a special edition of On Iowa Politics. As Iowa Governor Terry Branstad prepares to head off to Beijing as United States Ambassador to China, we've convened a panel of reporters familiar with Branstad from his days as the nation's youngest governor to its longest-serving governor to talk about his legacy. Hi, I'm James Lynch of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. With me today are Gazette Des Moines Bureau Chief Rod Beauchart. Hello, Rod.
Hello.
Radio Iowa Political Director Kay Henderson. Hi, Kay.
Good day.
Gazette columnist Todd Dorman. Hello, Todd.
Hello.
And former Gazette reporter and columnist Ken Sullivan. And welcome back, Ken.
Thanks a lot, Jim. Good to be here.
You can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and subscribe to On Iowa Politics on iTunes and Stitcher. This podcast is part of an extensive look at Branstad years, available in print and online at the Gazette and the Gazette online, thegazette.com. Ken, while most of us are familiar with Terry Branstad 2.0, remind us of who Terry Branstad was when he arrived on the statewide scene as, well, first as a legislator, but yeah. As a lieutenant governor in 1979, and then when he became governor the first time in 1982.
My first year covering the legislature, covering statewide politics, was 1980. And Terry was obviously governor at that point, or lieutenant governor at that point. And he did have, two terms in the legislature before that. And frankly, I don't know of anybody who really anticipated Terry was going to be governor for life and, be the success he is turning out to be. I want to just toss a few things out and maybe stimulate some conversation. I don't recall that then legislator, now governor, had really stood out amongst his 150 peers during that early period. I suppose I should have some sense of why Bob Ray chose him as his running mate, or I don't know. They weren't choosing. The candidates weren't choosing the running mates at that point.
They ran separately, the lieutenant
governor
and governor.
Yeah, that's right. So that answers that question.
Well, were his ambitions obvious when you started covering statewide
politics? I don't recall him being a mover and an ambitious, politically ambitious. But clearly he saw something in that jurisdiction or that domain that appealed to him. Terry, I have a difficult time. I should call him governor just to be proper and polite and all that stuff.
Respectful
but
and all
I,
that.
But I've known him, and I'm older than him. Anyhow, he was a small-town lawyer, Lake Mills, Iowa. He was a landlord, owns a few, I don't know if he still owns a few post offices that were a revenue source for him. When he was, I think, running for governor, he was in a car crash. And that gave rise to his mustache because he's got a scar hidden under all that hair. My mustache is beard are because of my chins. When he became governor, I think the last person I would have expected, one of the last people I would have expected to see on that podium for the state of the state was Terry Branstad. He followed, Governor Ray was a fairly accomplished speaker. We have a history of some really fine orators in Iowa politics. Harold Hughes for one, John Culver for another. The governor seemed to be a little bit uncomfortable with his messages to the General Assembly, but I think his strength, early strength at least, and it evolved into something long term, he was good with small groups of people. He could go before a group of people and have them very pleased to be in his presence. He also had a wonderful mentor that I think, outside of their backgrounds. He's a Chuck Grassley as far as the ability to create a campaign, a successful campaign. He's probably got as good a support list as Grassley does. He may have the same ones. I don't know. Anyhow, there are a lot of things. I'm not. We've talked to James over the last couple of years about rumors that he was going to resign, and have the lieutenant governor step in, but never for this reason. I think did anybody anticipate that would happen.
Right. Kay, I want to go to you and follow up on something that Ken said about the governor having this ability to go in front of small groups and generally come away with them feeling positive about him. And it seems like a number of times through his tenure, he's been unpopular for one thing or another. And yet, when we've covered him speaking to a small group, whether it's out in outstate Iowa or a small gathering in Des Moines, it does seem like he's able to win people over and come away with sort of a positive attitude.
He has an uncanny ability to remember names and places. If he meets someone from a town, say Seymour, where he has been multiple times, but he doesn't know this person, he will discuss his most recent trip to Seymour, or perhaps his first trip to Seymour. If he sees a person, he will remember that person. I remember in the 2010 campaign being around him when he saw somebody in a crowd in Creston, Iowa, went up to her and spoke to her, and then got on the campaign bus and was absolutely frantic because he had forgotten her name. And spent 5 minutes talking to his staff and whomever he could speak with on the phone to figure out that person's name, and then sent someone to speak with her again. So he is absolutely obsessed with connecting with people on a personal level where they live.
Yeah, that's one thing that has always struck me is his ability to remember people, and not only remember their name, but make some sort of connection to him that your uncle taught my brother geometry, in high school,
exactly.
Those sorts of things. And I mean, I think we've all seen him do that just to one person after another. I guess for a politician, being able to remember names and faces is a great attribute, and he certainly has capitalized on it.
He always mentions to me that my dad coached Little League on a team opposite when he played Little League.
And that goes back.
He knows my dad's name, asked me how he is, and it's like he's got a story for all 3 million Iowans.
Right, exactly.
Exactly.
I think he knows them all. I think one of the interesting aspects of the Brandsdale era for me has been how many times he's come out in opposition to something, and then maybe a year or years later turned around and found some way to support it. And I'm thinking of sales tax increases, gambling, issues like that. Rod, how does the governor do what I think other politicians would be nailed with as flip-floppers? Somehow he's been able to do this.
I think he always was able to sort of make the best of whatever the situation was and turn it to his advantage. And I don't know if that's something that he learned from the political consultants he worked with through the years, but he had an uncanny ability to say with riverboat gambling. I don't think he necessarily, or any of the gambling, I don't know if he necessarily was the big promoter of it, but once he saw that it was going to happen, riverboat gambling became a family tourism activity. It wasn't like the evils of gambling. It was, boy, this is good. This is something the whole family can go out on a cruise, and it'll be a throwback to a earlier, simpler time. and all of a sudden, and also it would be economic development, and it would be tourism. And you found yourself sort of getting caught up in a concept that maybe at the beginning you would have just looked at as a sort of a voluntary tax.
I agree with you, Rod, that he had a good touch or good feel for what the masses of people wanted, and I think Riverboat or Gambling, the whole package, was something like that. And we forget that, we don't forget, but we overlook the fact that that was supposed to be a boon for educational funding in the great state of Iowa, because that was supposed to be targeted for K-12, and it obviously goes into the general fund, and the rest comes out now.
The fact that he's been able
Kay. The other thing is, you know, he did not sign into law a bill legalizing the lottery the first time it landed on his desk, and by the time he did sign that bill into law, he did it on the west steps of the state house with dozens of legislators behind him, because he acknowledged that public opinion was against him, and he signed the bill into law.
That was the first time his desk was taken out of his formal office and put on the west steps.
Well, and you know, sometimes it caught his party off guard when he would switch positions. But I'm going to expose my youth and experience maybe, but the first thing I remember about that was when I was a page in the House, and I was assigned to be the page for the House caucus, the Republican caucus. It was a pretty small Republican caucus at that point. And the minimum wage came up, and Branstad had urged them to stand strong against it. He was against it, and it passed, and he had a big signing ceremony, kind of like he did with the lottery. Republicans were mad. They had Don Paulin, who was the legislative liaison for the governor at that time, and that was one of the few times they asked me to leave the room when I was a page, because there was going to be some loud voices. And so I stood in the hallway and saw Don Paulin look at his shoes while he got yelled at, and for a young guy, just sort of, you know, like myself, forming my political experience, that was the first time I ever saw anyone taken to the woodshed. So it was a special moment.
Gee, sounds like Trump, doesn't it? Similarities. So
he was against it before he was for it.
The other thing about that was that one of the reasons he did sign that into law was because Don Avenson was Speaker of the Iowa House of Representatives, right. And Don Avenson was running for governor, so he took away a huge issue that Avenson could have throttled him with in the general election by actually approving the minimum wage hike.
And as a page making minimum wage, I was 100% for it.
Good point. So I'm
overpaid.
Curious, does
the Republicans at the time in the Iowa Senate felt like he had completely pulled the rug out from under them, and it was a long time before he was welcomed back in the Senate chambers, as far as they were concerned.
So Governor Branstad's ability or willingness to sort of change his position to fit the political situation or to align himself with public attitudes, does this suggest that he was pragmatic or that he lacked principle, that he was just willing to do whatever it took?
I lean toward the pragmatic. I think he has principles. I think he's a moral person. I think he was wise enough to be able to gauge the flow of public opinion. He's a very fortunate guy to be elected all these times, and you know, the luck of the draw, the good candidates or good opponents, bad opponents. He came through them all, and I think he was able to adapt his message and his energy to what the public sentiment wanted.
I think I remember a column that Donald Call wrote where he referred to him as the Audie Murphy of weather vane politics. anyone that's too young is going to have to look up Audie Murphy. I think that was kind of, you know, it was an appropriate, it was a good line.
if you look through your history, and I think some of you were during the campaign when I think his only serious challenge, his biggest challenge, was Fred Grandy for the primary, and I truly was a little bit surprised that he carried it, because Grandy came in well funded but I think that was the moderate faction, whatever, of the Republican Party was not strong enough, or as strong as the party that the group that the governor.
And for our younger people listening, Fred Grandy, the former Love Boat actor, challenged Branstad in the
Gopher.
Gopher. Played the role of Gopher on the Love Boat. Challenged Branstad in the 1994 primary, and came very close, to winning that primary. Obviously, he had a lot of support from, as Ken mentioned, the sort of the moderate to liberal wing of the Republican Party. And in those days, there was a moderate and liberal wing of the Republican Party. Also, a lot of Democrats, I think, were pulling for Fred Grandy as a way of stopping Branstad.
That would have been the year that, who was it? Was it Junkins or Avenson or who ran on the Democratic side?
Bonnie Campbell, I think.
Was it Bonnie?
Yeah, 94.
Yeah. And maybe we should talk just a little bit about, the people who Branstad ran against. Bonnie Campbell, obviously one of those folks. The first campaign was against Roxanne Conlon. And Avenson, I'm drawing a blank now.
Yeah, I am too. Junkins and Roxanne.
And then when he came back, Culver and Jack Hatch. And Ken, you talked about sort of the luck of the draw of the people he ran against. Roxanne Conlon was sort of a newcomer to elected politics, but had a reputation. Bonnie Campbell, certainly no slouch in Iowa Democratic politics. Avenson, longest-serving Speaker of the House. Junkins, another legislator. So, and Culver, coming from a political family and was an incumbent when Branstad ran against him. So, sometimes people sort of dismiss his victories that he didn't run against the strongest candidates. But when you look back at it, these folks in their own right were formidable candidates.
To an extent, though, Jim, they all came in with some sort of baggage. Roxanne's husband was involved with some real estate stuff that may or may not have been... I don't remember the details.
He didn't pay property tax.
Tax or something like that. And
income. They didn't pay any state income.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And... Bonnie was very active. She was identified more with the Democratic Party hierarchy, I think. Her husband was state chair or something, Ed, and they'd been, and I don't know if she really was able to break through that shield that Terry had built up in amongst some of the more moderate. Even some of the more moderate Democrats. Mm-hmm. Avenson and Junkins, powerful people in the legislature, but I don't know if they had much of a statewide cachet.
Kay, one of the things that I think it was Ken mentioned earlier is that Branstad he's created his own sort of campaign machinery and it runs his own campaign sometimes. Sort of to the chagrin of the party that he hasn't always been a good team player, I guess. Certainly in the last election, he was out there in front Republican candidates. But when you look at his impact on the Republican Party, given how long he's been at the top of the Republican Party in Iowa, and you consider the changes in the Republican Party over that period of time, how much impact has Terry Branstad had on the Iowa Republican Party?
Well, he installed in the 1990s, as I recall, his law partner from Lake Mills, Rich Schwarm, to be chairman of the Iowa GOP. He, as you've covered just moments ago, sort of was able to change with the times, and he came into office as a conservative, as did Chuck Grassley 2 years prior at the federal level as a U.S. senator, whereas the man that he replaced as governor, Robert Ray, was seen as a quote-unquote moderate Republican. And so perhaps as we look over the decades that Branstad has been at the helm of the State House and in some respects at the helm of the State Party, the state party has very much moved in Terry Branstad's direction in terms of its stance on major issues, especially the abortion issue.
In some way,
it seems like he was the first Reagan conservative to emerge that sort of bucked the whole Robert Ray moderate kind of approach to things. I think in 76 he was an alternate delegate to the National Convention as a Reagan delegate, and that's when Ray was being kicked around as a possible running mate for Gerald Ford. And it always struck me interesting that on the one hand you had Terry Branstad, who would go to these events, who loved Iowa, loved people, did proclamation signings, did ribbon cuttings, did basically whatever he had to do to endear himself to people. But on the political side, he wasn't afraid to go for the jugular. He would use his fundraising advantage to jump on his opponents early. He defined them in a negative way and create doubt for voters before the opponent even had a chance to define themselves. And I think he picked up a lot of his campaigning skills from Roger Ailes. We were talking with him in Cleveland when Ailes was in the news, and he sort of learned a lot from him, and it seemed like when you referenced the Grandy race, I remember Branstad holding press conferences and sort of referencing that Grandy was kind of flighty, or he would say impetuous like an actor. And it struck me that wasn't a word that Branstad usually used. And I thought, man, that thing is focus group tested. And basically there was some coaching to use that, because that was going to undermine Grandy's executive decision-making arguments.
Just to interject here, Roger Ailes, who passed away this week, was, I think, media advisor was his, or media consultant.
Right, for two campaigns.
For two of the Branstad gubernatorial campaigns. So there was a relationship there where he was taking advice from Roger Ailes, who created Fox News as we know it today. Moving on from sort of his...
Well, and he would come up with slogans that were like, it always was like, junk bond junkins,
right. Yeah.
Or don't
yes.
gamble with Campbell, and with, it was big debt Chet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he always had a hook that was also a negative.
I mean, in a way, he did everything right as a politician. He raised lots of money. As you mentioned, Rod, he defined his opponent very early, and they struggled to get beyond that definition. And then he always had some simple slogan, easy to remember, you know, junk bonds, junkin', those sorts of things that, you know, people could fit on a bumper sticker or a placard or whatever. I mean, he really ran some good campaigns in that way.
He also was always... on politically. He always, I think, was measuring everything and running it through everything through a political consideration, sort of a political sieve. And I remember I was stationed in the Quad Cities for a time, and he would go around and do these fly-around press conferences. And I remember going to the Eldridge Airport and getting there and thinking, okay, this is a press event. But there were about 50 to 75 supporters there, mm-hmm. who kind of packed the room. And so you were there to do a press conference. But if you ask any kind of a negative question, there would be grumbling in the crowd or even boos. I mean, he knew how to play the system. To his advantage.
Can I pick up on that a little bit, Rod? I wanted to ask you. Mm-hmm. We've all covered the governor very closely during campaigns and things, and I recall one time we were in a Winnebago, obviously, coming back from someplace northeast Iowa, and I figured I was alone, only reporter. I figured I'm going to get him. No, I not get him. I, not the way things go now. I just wanted to get a down-to-earth, real people Terry Branstad quote or three. And I said, "What do you like to do Saturday nights when you don't have an event?" He said, "Oh, I love to sit home with Chris and Terrace Hill with Chris and have a pizza brought in." And, "Oh, come on, Terry, that's too much out of the, you know, Leave It to Beaver book." And he never, what you said, he was never off stage. I don't know what his private persona is like when he's home and spills a cup of coffee on the table or something like that. But whenever I was with him, whenever the public was with him, he always had the politically well thought out response. He was chameleon-esque in the way he responded.
Yeah, he was always on message, whatever his message was.
And it was not a, I never felt like he was terribly open beyond message, ask about the kids or anything like that.
It's been interesting in recent weeks as we've, been waiting for his confirmation as ambassador to China. At bill signings at the end of the session, we were asking him about, his time in office. Was he sentimental, nostalgic? It's as if he doesn't want to look back at all, and he just continues to talk about whatever is right in front of him, what the legislature was doing, or those sorts of things. And I mean, I don't know how many times we asked that one day at a bill signing. I mean, multiple reporters asked multiple times, and he just was not going to look back. He was not going to talk about being, the early years and whether he was sentimental about leaving office or anything like that. So I don't know that we ever really saw that personal side of Terry Branstad. Yeah. It was always the public side, the politician, the governor. And it was very rare that he made an off-the-cuff statement that kind of gave us a glimpse at Terry Branstad, the private person.
You who cover him and are with him on a more regular basis, what do you think about his potential as a internationally important diplomat for the country?
Well, I think, I mean, he should be able to do a good job. I mean, given all his experience, he's, in terms of running an embassy, he probably should be able to do that quite handily, and there'll be professional staff that will handle day-to-day things. The fact that he has this relationship with Xi Jinping certainly helps. On the other hand, when was the last time you read a news story about what the ambassador to China said or did?
Yeah.
It's not as if, I mean, it's a very important relationship because of you have the two most powerful countries in the world and two largest economies, all, but at the same time, I'm not sure that the day-to-day events, shaping the world are going to rest on Terry Branstad's shoulders. When something goes wrong, probably the ambassador will know it. But I think he'll do a good job.
Diplo-speak, all it takes. I mean, he can't develop any personal relationship or anything, or can he develop any personal relationship beyond the?
Well, I think I think he has a curiosity that when he visits somewhere, he wants to know about it. So that may be welcome in China if he visits somewhere outside of Beijing and he says he's going to visit all the provinces. There's not a 99 county tour, but there'll be
the Great Wall is a real treat.
Yeah, and there are five consulates there, so he plans to visit all the consulates, and so I think that will, his curious nature and his ability to deal with people, I think, will serve him well. I think he'll be challenged by the Chinese language, but even more so than he is by the English language. But I expect he'll do a good job.
To an extent, this could be his biggest political challenge.
Yeah, I mean, he's talked about it as the capstone of his career, and that's probably a good way to describe it. Speaking of capstones, let's talk a little bit about Terry Branstad's greatest accomplishments. And I guess I think about, the 1980s and the farm crisis, the rural crisis. And I wasn't paying a whole lot of attention to Iowa politics at that time. But it seems like he's given a lot of credit for at least making sure things didn't get worse than they were. Ken, you said you started covering him in 1980.
As lieutenant governor, and I followed him until he left in what, 96?
98.
Okay. And I thought about this after you asked me to share in this thing. And I can't remember a standout program that came from his pen. I mean, he's like a lot of politicians. They'll take credit for somebody else's ideas and thoughts. But I really can't, nothing jumps out. I think he had in some ways a strong legislature in his good years, but I just can't, nothing leaps out.
When people think about Robert Ray, who was governor before Branstad, and you know, you ask about his accomplishments, the thing that comes to mind is resettlement of Vietnamese and Laotian refugees and this opening up Iowa. What are people going to remember about Terry Branstad 20 years from now, 50 years from now, Kay?
Well, one thing that was a complicating factor in building a legacy was that Terry Branstad has not had a tenure that Bob Ray did. Bob Ray was governor when he had a Republican-led House and a Republican-led Senate. Terry Branstad was into, I believe, his third term before he actually had a Republican legislature with which to work and pass some of his legislation that he had hoped. And one of the marquee issues of the 1994 campaign was reinstatement of the death penalty. It passed the Iowa House, which Republicans controlled. It got to the Senate, where Republicans were also in control, but it couldn't pass because of public pressure that was, I guess carried the day back in the 1990s. So if you look at the legacy, I think what you see really is Branstad in many ways chipping away at things and remaking things in the way, you know, an artist does with a block of stone. This past week I did a story about how Branstad had sort of chipped away at the Iowa tax code. He never did get that huge, momentous, you know, we're going to boil the tax code down to a postcard, but he did eliminate the tax on machinery and equipment in the 1980s, and then in this most recent term, he eliminated the tax on the inputs for manufacturers, which the business community very much appreciates. He erased the income tax on Social Security income. He erased the income tax on military pensions. He also did things, as we all recall, on this this conversation a few years ago. He signed what was billed as the largest tax cut in Iowa history, that $4 billion over 10-year cut in commercial income taxes. And then at the very end of his first four-term run as governor, he signed a bill that cut Iowans' individual income taxes by 10% across the board. So he was able to, I think, accomplish some of his ultimate goals by just chipping away at things. And you saw that also this year on the abortion issue.
Yeah, good point that he, you know, little by little,
think,
he got his...
I think one of the things that stands out, and he did this in concert with the legislature, but during that farm crisis, they diversified the Iowa economy. I think they realized that all the they were too dependent on one sector of the economy, and they added value to agriculture and sort of went forward. I mean, Vilsack picked up the ball and took it as well, but I think it was during that farm crisis period that Iowa's economy really stepped up its game. He also, I think, expanded Iowa's reach in the world. He probably was the most well-traveled of any governor. He led trade missions to Asia, to Europe, to South America, met Pope John Paul II, did all those kind of things. He was kind of a born salesman for Iowa, and he really believed in his product. And then one of his shrewdest moves, I think, both for the state and for his political standing, was to push incessantly to keep the Iowa caucuses first in the nation. That both raised his own political stock, and it opened doors that might otherwise not have opened to him as governor, as the leadoff state in the selection process.
Erod, where would you put his role in ethanol? I mean, that probably is the most enduring change that I can think of right now.
Well, I think if you, both ethanol and just renewable energy in general,
yeah.
I mean, the whole the Iowa landscape is dotted with ethanol plants, with windmills.
But did he have a part in that?
That very much is part of his legacy,
okay.
I think.
I mean, it seems like everything he did was about economic development, whether it was a trade mission or ethanol or the tax code. I mean, his justification for everything seemed to be economic development, almost to the point of, you know, like making me tired of hearing the term.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, he was sort of the father of this idea of, you know, in Iowa of the alphabet programs providing incentives.
Mm-hmm.
And tax credits, and you know, out of the farm crisis, that made sense, because as Rod said, he was trying to diversify the economy, which was the right thing to do, and I think is a big positive in his legacy. I mean, the flip side of that is that now almost every venture, you know, has incentives of some sort baked into the pie, so that's kind of the legacy too, is that now we live in a world where economic development projects expect public
mm-hmm.
participation. You know, it's his second time around, but I think his decision to privatize the Medicaid program is going to be a big part of his legacy. We have yet to see how that's entirely going to play out. There are troubling signs, but he said that there's going to be savings. And as among the unilateral decisions he made, I can't think of one that's going to have a bigger impact than that in the years to come. I mean, it affects 500,000 people. It's a $5 billion program.
That raises a good point. And maybe a difference between Branstad in the early years and Branstad 2.0 when after he came back to office after 12 years in the private sector. And I'm thinking that the economist John Maynard Keynes said that politicians and government officials rarely are influenced by new ideas after the age of 30. And certainly when Branstad came back, he was well past the age of 30. Do you think that when he came back, he had been gone too long and was too old to come back and, I mean, really move government forward? Had he lost anything during his time away from Terrace Hill?
Why did he come back? I mean, bottom line, why did he come back?
Well, you know, I mean, his justification always was that people wanted him to come back because state government was in such a mess and, you know, big debt, and he had to clean things up. And you know, ever since he came back, he's been blaming everything on Chet Culver. So that was his reason for coming back.
And that's after 12 years. But
yeah.
What happened? What did he do in those 12 years?
Well, probably the most significant was he was president of Des Moines University. Which actually, you know, when he ran in 2010, he talked a lot about what he had learned as the president of the university, and it seemed like my impression was that it was a good learning experience for him. It gave him perspective that he didn't have as a government official. But at times when I look at what he's accomplished since he came back, other than privatizing Medicaid, what's the big program? What is he, you know, it's almost, I mean, he was fixated on balancing the budget, which is not a bad thing.
I just had the feeling, though, that there wasn't anything out there during that 12-year period that was as comfortable for him or that he felt as suited for as governor, and that's why...
Yeah, there is a lot of evidence that he likes to be governor.
Yeah. we've noticed.
We've got six terms to prove it.
Yeah, but I, you know, Governor Ray became, you know, he left office after whatever, however many years, and Life Investors, and he was in constant demand for something. I don't recall Governor Branstad having that kind of appeal.
Yeah,
and I know. He started out, I think, looking for an executive job. I don't know if that ever, how quickly that attached to him.
Yeah. Rod, when you think about Branstad, the early years versus the current terms in office, what are the biggest differences that you see?
I think his first go around, he came from the legislature and as a lieutenant governor into the governorship. I think he followed the Ray model for a time until he got his sea legs, so to speak, and he also viewed the process from the inside, whereas I think when he took a break and was gone for 12 years, not only did it drive him crazy what Democrats were doing in Terrace Hill, but he had 6 years as president of Des Moines University where he developed, I think, a CEO mentality. I think he got used to giving directions and having people carry them out so that once he came back to the governorship, I saw him as much more unilateral, like a CEO would be. That there had been recommendations made and given to close the MHIs for I don't know how many years, and lawmakers ignored them or couldn't pass it because it would affect their districts. And he basically just said, "Okay, I'm not going to fund them, and if you don't like it, then stop me." And they couldn't. Same way with closing the juvenile home in Toledo and privatizing Medicaid. Those were decisions that he essentially made as a CEO, and away they went.
Well, and that may be part of his legacy, is that he's laid the groundwork for a different kind of governor. I mean, regardless of who, I mean, obviously Kim Reynolds is going to take over for him. But after the next election, you know, he's basically opened the door if somehow a Democrat wins, you know, executive orders and executive sort of decisions like that to change vast parts of government without legislative authority or without, you know, checking with stakeholders. That's now on the table.
We've already heard one of the candidates for governor in 2018 talk about the first thing he's going to do is an executive order to undo the collective bargaining bill that passed this year. So, maybe that's the example that Terry Branstad has set now is sort of, you know, use your pen and your phone sort of governorship. Kay, any thoughts about the difference between early years and current times with the governor? How life in the private sector changed him? Or maybe it's just age.
I don't know so much as it was life in the private sector. I just think politics has changed since he had been in office in the last century, and things had speeded up. And he
don't say it that way, Kate.
Give him his due, he was an adapter. Mm-hmm. He surrounded himself with young staff. He obviously has some old hands who've stuck around, namely Dave Roeder, who is the Department of Management Director, who's had a number of different positions within the Branstad administration over his several terms. However, if you look at his staff makeup now, these are mainly new people who he's brought on board, and he started doing that when he retook the office in 2011. He is a person who seems to be actually incredibly energized about this job that he'll be taking in China. It had been, I think, rather remarkable that he was able to convince his reluctant wife, Chris, to go along. She, among all of the folks in the Branstad orbit, has always been the least reluctant to stand in the political spotlight. But once they got her on board, it's smooth sailing on a slow boat to China. At least he said his... many of his belongings will be going on a slow boat to China. I'm sure he'll be taking one of those jets over there.
How
I think that was true in 2009 as well. I remember when he announced, we all went over to Des Moines University, and he announced that he was going to re-enter the political arena. Chris was there, and I got the impression that she wasn't necessarily on board, but was going to go along with it. But at that time, I think the Republicans realized that their bench was depleted, and I know the governor likes to perpetuate this idea that he was drafted into coming back, but I talked to Rich Swarm, who was with him, and a group of Republicans who were looking to figure out who they could run in 2010, and were coming up short, and Branstad was part of this, and he made the point, you know, what are we looking for? We're looking for someone who's like me. Well, I'm like me. Let's run me. And then it became this, oh, they're drafting him. Well, yeah. Okay.
Well, they were afraid, you know, that Bob Vanderplaats was going to win the Republican nomination. Yeah. And, you know, I don't think it's any secret that folks like Doug Gross and those, they're not big proponents of BVP.
Since he came back, I think he led the charge within the party to build it back to what it is today,
right?
Including getting control of the legislature, and then almost I think it went beyond what I think they were more aggressive this session in doing things. He signed everything, mm-hmm. but he wasn't. It's sort of like once he created something that then went beyond what I think he envisioned.
You talk about the legacy of this governor. Will Kim be a legacy for him? Has he prepared her for? It's going to be a difficult year and a half, I suppose, because there are going to be challengers. Is she prepared enough? Has he prepared her well enough?
I think he has as well as you can. The one element that, I mean, she's always been able just to say what he said.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, that sort of deflector isn't going to be there anymore. So that'll be interesting going forward how to.
That basically is what I was thinking.
The training is.
Yeah, I'd never heard of her before, and then all of a sudden she's in every Branstad appearance by his shoulder. And does she look like a clone of Terry Branstad as far as policy, as far as has he equipped her for the challenges of, I go back to that, the challenges of dealing with those guys?
Ken, this is Kay at Radio
Iowa.
Yeah. One of the distinguishing features between Branstad in the 1990s and Branstad in this century is his relationship with his lieutenant governor. As we all recall, 1990 was the first year in which a governor chose a lieutenant governor running mate. Mm-hmm. And that year, because of the aforementioned House Speaker Don Avenson and the issue of abortion, Terry Branstad chose Joy Corning, a state senator at the time from Cedar Falls, who was well known in the Cedar Falls community through her service on the school board there, to be his running mate. But she in no way was a governing partner with Terry Branstad through the duration of those two remaining terms. In fact, those of us who covered the State House will remember that she was given an office in the governor's office that had been the former storage closet for stationery that it was imprinted with the governor's name. So it wasn't as if she was elevated to be the kind of lieutenant governor that Kim Reynolds has been. Kim Reynolds' office physically is more impressive and larger than the office, the formal office that the governor occupies. She has been in on every meeting or nearly every meeting we're told that he's had with department directors over the past few years, these 2 terms. And so in that respect, she's been a governing partner with Terry Branstad, and she's someone who is allied with him philosophically in a way that his previous lieutenant governor was not.
I think whether it's political pragmatism or vanity, I think he has tried to prepare a successor, and Kim Reynolds is the person he's chosen. But, you know, it's sort of like the backup quarterback. You can take the same number of reps as the first, as the starter, but until you get into the game, we really don't know how you're going to perform. I think her style will be different than Terry Branstad. I think for probably the short term, at least, her politics are going to be very similar to his. I would perhaps, if she is elected to the office in 2018, she'll be able to develop her own agenda and her own sort of political strategy. But I think for the short term, I would expect her to toe the Branstad line and continue his legacy in that way, I guess.
He's not going to be here to help her run
for
re-election.
Yeah. He's going to be half a world away.
Yeah.
And I don't get the impression that Kim Reynolds is going to be calling the governor to say, what do I do about this and what do I do about that,
no.
Or calling the ambassador to say that. I think she's confident in her in herself. I think we've sort of rambled around the Branstad years, the Branstad era, and tried to offer some perspective on his 22-plus years as governor of the state of Iowa. As we said, he came in as the nation's youngest governor, and he leaves as the nation's longest-serving governor. And I think just quickly before we go, Todd, I want to ask you about sort of the unfinished business. Is there unfinished business for the Branstad administration? You mentioned the Medicaid legacy he leaves.
Yeah.
Is anything else come to mind?
Well, and you know, Kay mentioned the tax reform that hasn't been done, and I think one of the ironies of passing big tax cuts like the commercial property tax cut is sometimes it doesn't leave you with revenue to do the other sort of tax relief you want to do, like income tax reform. So that's unfinished. Water quality is another unfinished issue. He was sort of a latecomer during the second part of his governorship to that issue and had some ideas that didn't pass, and that's still out there for his successor in the legislature to work on. So one of the other question marks as he leaves is, you know, what, as the Trump administration faces problems, I mean, what part of his, how will his legacy be affected by the fact that he was such an ardent supporter of Donald Trump? And if that presidency ends up collapsing in scandal, is that going to tarnish his reputation and his legacy? So, I mean, there's, it's still early. The legacy will take a while to sort of completely, you know, judge, but those are pieces of unfinished business and questions we still have.
And certainly the Branstad legacy, I suppose, is still being formed. His years in China, or however long he stays in China as ambassador, will be part of that legacy. But that's it for this special edition of On Iowa Politics. I hope it was worth your time, and thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends and subscribe to us on iTunes. And you can find it online at thegazette.com. This podcast has been part of an extended coverage of the Branstad years in print and online at the Gazette and thegazette.com. For Rod Beauchard in our Des Moines Bureau, Kay Henderson from Radio Iowa, Ken Sullivan, a retired columnist and reporter from the Gazette, Todd Dorman, Gazette columnist, and our producers, Max and Sarah, I'm James Lynch. Thanks for listening.